This is a message from the Majority Report at majority.fm. You can help a sometimes overweight, sometimes he maintains his weight, somewhat middle-aged man. Keep providing you with great content on a daily basis through the Majority FM for just 50 cents a day. And when you become a member at majority.fm for 50 cents a day, $10 a month, you know, you can spend more than that if you want. I mean, I don't mean to inhibit you in any way. We will send you a picture of Sam Cedar that you can keep in your wallet. Well, actually, we'll post one on the blog at majority.fm. Actually, there's one already there. All right, so just become a member.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 18th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting almost live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my vacation week. And while I am right now probably lounging by the pool having a pina colada, while I'm being serenaded by some type of indigenous band, or just doing chores for Nikki and making sure that Milo stays out of trouble, it doesn't matter. I know that your insatiable desire for new content never wanes, even when I am taking a vacation. As such, we will have on this week all new interviews, sometimes more than one new interview, sometimes a new interview, and some maybe some recycled stuff. It doesn't matter. You're always going to get some fresh content, so sit back and enjoy. Remember, you're all 300 million strong, greedy teat suckers, and as such, here is the huge teat of the Majority Report that you can now suck on. So, folks, on the telephone device, and this is actually a long-distance call, which is just another reason why we need your membership. But be that as it's actually Skype. It's free. On the phone, Johan Hari. He's an award-winning journalist who writes for The Independent UK. You can see his stuff in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Le Monde, as we say in this part of the world. Welcome to the program, Johan.
Hey, Sam. It's great to be with you.
Now, there's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about, but obviously, one of the really pressing things that's happening now, and it's actually, you know, I was on MSNBC like 6 months ago, and the question was posed to us. Britain is now about to engage in an austerity program, or has determined they're about to engage in one. Do you think that we're going to hear any lessons from this? Is this going to be a model for us? And, of course, now that we're starting to see the implications of British austerity, and we're essentially in the process of the U.S. establishment deciding that's what we need, I thought now would be a great opportunity to ask you, how's it going over there with the austerity?
You're right. It's a great model of how not to do things. I mean, just to talk to you about some of the social costs, you know, give you just a couple of examples. It's not just, this is affecting everyone's lives now. The governor of the Bank of England, who is no one's idea of a left winger, said we're experiencing the worst squeeze in middle class family living standards since the 1920s. And whether it's some of the best children's hospitals are having huge crises, laying off loads of staff. You know, most of our homeless hostels are being shut down. Most of our shelters for victims of domestic violence are being shut down. In London alone, 200,000 poor people are being made homeless because the housing subsidies for them are being taken away. Even the Conservative mayor of this city, Boris Johnson, called that Kosovo-style social cleansing. This idea that in a democracy you can cut massive amounts of government spending on the poor and the middle class and not have a huge number of victims is proving to be totally wrong. Also, crucially, it doesn't work. It doesn't achieve its central goal. Every time they introduce a new program of cuts, economic growth goes massively down and the ability to pay the debt goes massively down. So it doesn't even work on its own terms. If your economy is collapsing, you can't pay off your debts. It's really interesting. Our equivalent to the Treasury Secretary, George Osborne, said in 2006, look and learn from across the Irish Sea. He said Ireland was the model he wanted to follow for Britain. Well, you've got to admit he's been honest on that one. You know, we followed Ireland into the absolute sinkhole, and it would be crazy for the US to follow us. And it looks like, unfortunately, because of these deranged cuts that Obama has agreed to, you're heading our way pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, let's go backwards a little bit, because we should talk about, first off, you know, when we talk about British society, we're talking about a society that provides a far greater amount of social services for the middle class than ours does. And so the imposition of these cuts, well, what was the justification at the time? I mean, take us back when it was, I guess, maybe 6 months ago now, when the decision to impose these cuts was made. What was the theory?
It was an almost entirely fictitious one, which was that we're in the middle of a debt crisis, our debt is freakishly high, we need to panic. In fact, Britain's national debt has been higher for 200 of the past 250 years. If we're bankrupt now, we were bankrupt when we built our health service, we were bankrupt when we built our pension system, we were bankrupt when we beat the Nazis, we were bankrupt when we ruled most of the world. In fact, what's really bankrupt is this whole way of looking at national economies, which is based on a basic misunderstanding. It's a return to pre-Great Depression understanding of economics. When I read Paul Krugman, the great Nobel Prize-winning economist, some of David Cameron's speeches, he gasped and said, well, this is pure Herbert Hoover economics. You know, one of the things we learned in the 1930s is that in a recession, totally sensibly, individuals like you and me spend less and save more if we possibly can. If at the same time the government is doing that, then demand completely collapses because no one is spending. So you have to do something a little bit counterintuitive. We learned this from the greatest Englishman of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes. You have to do something slightly counterintuitive. When individuals cut back their spending, the government has to do the opposite. The government has to borrow and spend, or a recession turns into a depression. The government has to take out the jump leads. Now, obviously, David Cameron ignored all that. He ignored the fact all the economists who've been consistently right throughout this crisis and went for massive cuts, and we're seeing the cost. You know, the cost is huge social collapse, disaster for the country, and you can't even pay your debts then, because, you know, you can't pay your debts if you ain't got any money. You know, that's what happened. You can't pay your debts. And the quick analogy would be if, you know, you and me were to get so panicked about our mortgage that we stopped buying food and starved, and then our house got repossessed anyway.
That's right.
And so, you know, if you have any extra money, then you can't pay your debts. You know, the way out of this is growth. You know, that's what Paul Krugman has been saying. That's what Joseph Stiglitz has been saying. That's what all the Nobel Prize-winning economists who've been right throughout this crisis have been saying. But just like the Republicans, David Cameron has been shifting the argument to blame this crisis, which is a crisis that was caused by deregulation, by the government not acting, by the government failing to regulate the banking system, blaming it somehow on big government. It's absurd. It's like blaming 9/11 on Snooki. It's a completely bizarre misallocation of blame to a group of people who had nothing to do with it.
Right, and we all know Snooki was far too young at that time to have really been involved in any fashion whatsoever. But the interesting thing, though, is
That's not what I hear.
Well, we may have to do a special investigative report on the show in terms of Snooki. But wait a second. I want to go back. You said it's a misunderstanding of economic principles, and this is the thing that you know sort of continues to baffle me as we see the same misunderstanding in quotes taking place in this country. Because when this government and it, as well as yours found itself in or trumped up the notion that this debt and deficit was a crisis, the idea was that it's going to scare away essentially people who are willing to lend money to the country to finance the deficit or the debt, bondholders. And the idea is that if we prove to them that we are going to make cuts and bring the deficit down, theoretically, it is going to renew their desire to loan us money. Now, in this country, 10-year Treasury bonds are still below 4% in terms of return, signifying that it's not a very risky investment. Otherwise, we would have to give you more returns for it. Same with the 20- and 30-year bonds. At the time where the Cameron administration decided to, or government decided to impose these cuts, what was the bond situation? I mean, the idea is that we're going to create confidence and fairies are going to come and then all of a sudden everything's going to be fine.
You're so right. Two countries have just been massively punished by the bond market. What were they? Ireland and Portugal. What had Ireland and Portugal been doing for 2 years? They had been massively cutting. They'd been implementing extremely stringent austerity programs. That's why the bond market turned on them, because they imposed austerity programs and their economies collapsed. So this idea that the way to fend off the bond markets or please the bond markets is to precipitate an economic collapse by abandoning all the most basic Keynesian principles is the opposite of the truth. You know, and it's very clear the bond markets, when have the bond markets been threatening to downgrade Britain? It's not when we were borrowing. It's recently, because our economic growth is so bad, the bond market started warning that we might get in trouble. You know, it's really important. We are not, you know, as Paul Krugman keeps saying, the United States and Britain can get very good and favorable terms to borrow on the bond market at the moment. We can afford a Keynesian stimulus to get our economy back on its feet, to get people back to work. Indeed, we need it. The idea that we can't afford it, or that somehow the bond markets will punish us, is not true. You know, Krugman has that great phrase. He calls it the confidence fairy, this kind of magical confidence fairy which will come back. In fact, far from confidence coming back, we've seen a collapse in confidence in response to the austerity here. Also, he talks about the claims about the bond market. He calls them invisible bond vigilantes. The right has created a bond market that isn't there and isn't saying what they say it's saying.
Bond market is completely irrational. And they're not players who know what they're doing, because otherwise they would be demanding higher interest rates for their loans right now. And if they're that irrational in the first place, then creating confidence because you're cutting is not going to happen either.
You're totally right that the bond market is inconsistent. But, you know, look at what they've done to Portugal and to Ireland. They did that because of the effects of austerity. So what you've got to do is you've got to choose what is best for your economy and what is best for jobs and what's best for growth. That's what you have to do.
And you make a good point that at these interest rates, it's almost ridiculous not to borrow money. Because the scenario everybody's talking about is that there's bound to be some inflation. In fact, we want some measure of inflation because wages will come up. It will take some debt pressure off. And at that point, you're going to have money that you're paying 3 or 4% interest on when interest rates are closer to 5 or 6%. So
we learned in the 1930s. Debt is part of the solution here, not part of the problem. Look at what happened in your country in the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt, every year that Franklin Roosevelt borrowed and spent to get the economy moving again, the economy grew and unemployment fell. 1937, he starts listening to the shrieking deficit hawks we hear now. What happened? The economy started to go right down again. The only thing that ended the Great Depression was an absolutely massive stimulus called the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not urging Germany to invade Poland, but that was a way in which you then got absolutely massive government spending that did in fact end the Depression, you know? When we've listened to these people in the past, it's led to a disaster. You know, which countries have done best in this recession and which have done worst? The country that has had the biggest fiscal stimulus, South Korea, came out of this recession fastest. The country that followed the Cameron Tea Party script most closely was Ireland, and it's had the worst economic collapse of any country since the Second World War. That should tell us something. You know, there is a real world out there. There are enough countries trying enough different solutions that we can see the effects of these policies. You know, but these are economic policies based on blind faith and on quasi-religious principles and a refusal to look at the evidence.
To what extent do you think that it's, I mean, my sense, at least in this country, at least coming from the Republicans, is that this is, the agenda is ideological, that there is an attempt to use this in sort of the classic shock doctrine scenario, to use this to reshape our society in a way that, you know, provides ultimately for less regulation. You know, the biggest cuts that we took in this budget deal were from the EPA, less regulation for industry, and essentially less of a safety net for the vast majority of Americans. And I mean, how is it similar in the UK?
Absolutely. What you just recently, a Conservative government minister boasted that they were making cuts bigger than Margaret Thatcher could have thought of in her wildest dreams. This is an ideological project, and it's also part of a trend that's been going on in Britain for quite a long time, which is the transfer of wealth upwards from the middle class and the poor to the bottom. In 1976, 65% of all of British GDP went in wages. Now it's down to 53%, and it's falling further. Where did it go? It went to the rich. It went to corporations. You know, this is part of a trend that's been going for a while. And actually, something that I think it's really useful to let your readers know about, your listeners know about, which is a real kickback against this in Britain that's been quite inspiring and quite interesting. What we've had here is what you guys have had since Reagan as well, which is the rich being effectively exempted from taxation. You know, for example, Philip Green, sixth richest man in Britain, earned £1.2 billion last year, paid no pounds in taxes. Look at another example, Vodafone, which is one of our biggest cell phone companies, had been refusing to pay a very large part of its tax bill for years. The last Labour government was pursuing it through the courts. They'd racked up £6 billion that they owed, which is equivalent to all the money for all the 200,000 people who are being forced out of their homes because the housing subsidies are being cut. And when the Conservatives came to office, they just cancelled Vodafone's tax bill, almost all of it. They just said, you know what, let it go. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And, you know, people like me wrote articles saying, isn't this terrible? But there was a kind of fatalistic mood that a lot of people have, a lot of liberals have a lot of the time. And then something really interesting happened. 12 ordinary citizens were meeting in a pub one day here in London, and they were really angry about this. And instead of just mouthing off, they suddenly thought, well, what could we do about this? What if we were to just announce on Twitter that on Saturday we're going to go to the biggest Vodafone store in London and we're going to physically shut it down? We're going to say, you want to operate on our streets? You pay our taxes, you know? So they did it. They announced it on Twitter. They went. They had the kind of Kevin Costner principle, you know, if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. So they went and they did it. And about 100 people turned up and they shut it down. And it got a little bit of flurry in the news, but not much. Then something really interesting happened. 2 days later in Leeds, a city quite far from London, another big group of people went and shut down the Vodafone store in outrage. And then the next weekend, in 50 places across Britain, people went and shut down their Vodafone shop. And it went on for weeks and weeks, and it's still going on. And it was and it became a really big news story that, hang on, we won't let these people rip us off. We pay our taxes. If we don't pay our taxes, we go to prison. You know, we won't sit here and take these cuts when almost all these cuts could be made up by making these grossly rich people just to pay their fair share. And it was an amazing thing to go to these protests and to see it, to see the reaction of the public, which was so positive. I've never been at a protest before where people passing in the street would come up and embrace you and say, I'm so glad someone's doing this. You know, and the mixture of people, you'd get elderly people who were frightened of losing their benefits. You'd get young people who were so angry that the educational costs were massively going up. It's been a really inspiring movement. It's also been huge in very conservative areas. Mm-hmm. Places like Tunbridge Wells, you know, which is synonymous with kind of English conservatism has one of the most active UK. They shut down their Vodafone store every week. You know, it's really popular. 77% of people in the polling say they believe there should be a crackdown on this. And it's really changed the argument, because until now there have been people saying the kind of Paul Ryan script, you know, yeah, there's definitely got to be cuts and it's definitely got to be targeted at the poor in the middle. And this movement has really shown that there's an alternative to that, you know, and it's already started working. The National Audit Office, which is kind of independent quasi-governmental body, has now announced they're going to have an investigation into the Vodafone tax bill. They're going to go through all the documents. That's a huge deal. Our equivalent to the IRS has announced that it's moving a large number of people from scrutinizing the tax bills of small business to scrutinizing the tax bills of big business. This has already had a huge effect. And I think in a way it's useful. Now, obviously, in America, my God, you've got an even bigger issue. You know, GE, one of your biggest corporations, right, not only paid no tax last year, but was actually given £3 billion of your money, of the money of everyone listening to this show, you know, as in tax credits and bonuses, you know. So,
well, to be fair, Jeffrey Immelt is working for the president to create jobs for us. So that's probably why he got some of those billions of dollars back. But so this is what you're basically talking about, is the UK Uncut movement.
Uncut, and there's been an American equivalent set up by some fantastic people. It originated in Jackson, Mississippi. People want to find out about that, they can go to www.usuncut.org. And, you know, the British example has really shown how this can be done. I think of it slightly the best way. It's a really good way to answer the right, because I think of it as a kind of thought experiment, right? Someone like Philip Green, massively rich man through running stores all across British high streets, says, well, why should I have to pay taxes? I did it all myself. I earned it myself. I hear this from the Republicans all the time. And I think, well, let's imagine a thought experiment, right? Let's take one of his stores called Topshop. And for 1 month, let's just test that, right? So he thinks he does it all himself. We'll let him do it all himself. We won't collect the garbage out the back of the shop. When the rats come, we won't send the pest control people. When he gets shoplifters in his shop, thieves, we won't send the police. If there's a fire, we won't send the fire brigade. When his staff get sick, we won't treat them in our hospitals. Oh, he can't employ anyone whose education was paid for by us. Let him come back to us at the end of that month and say he did it all himself. No, he didn't. He did it with money that you and me pay. And what we've seen is a situation where the super rich have become effectively parasitical. We provide all the services they depend on, the roads, the police, the fire brigade, and they don't pay anything back towards it. Indeed, they take our money, as you saw in the banking crisis. And it's simply not true to say that we can't do anything about this. You know, people say, oh, well, they store it in tax havens. What can we do? After the 9/11 attacks, it took 1 week for every Al-Qaeda account in the world to be shut down. Mm-hmm. Every single one, because there was political will to do it. In the early 90s, it's one of my favorite examples. In the early 1960s, Monaco, the tax haven, was refusing to hand over details of French tax dodgers to the French authorities. So Charles de Gaulle, the president, surrounded Monaco with tanks, cut off the water supply, and said, you ain't getting any water until you tell us what the tax returns are. And they gave in very quickly. You know, if you want to make tax havens hand it over, it's very easy. And actually, President Obama, talked a lot in the campaign about this. It was Frank Luntz, the opinion pollster, said it was some of his most popular lines. You know, he talks about how in the Cayman Islands, there's one building that houses 12,000 corporations. And he said that's either the biggest building in the world or the biggest tax scam on record. And he actually said, there's a quote from him, every dime of his spending and tax cut proposals, he said, will be paid for by closing corporate loopholes and tax havens. You know, well, that's not how it's turned out. In fact, as you said, he's been appointing huge numbers of tax dodgers to advise him, you know, rather than dealing with them. But I think the UK Uncut thing has shown lots of things. It's shown that ordinary people don't have to sit back and be ripped off by these people. The Government Accountability Office has given a list of the American corporations that are scamming you, that are stealing from you. You know, it's a long list, the ones that are using tax havens. Give you some: Apple, Bank of America, Best Buy, ExxonMobil, FedEx, Kraft Foods, McDonald's, Safeway, Target. You know, don't let them do this to you. Act in your own self-defense. That's what UK Uncut has done. They've just gone and shut down these shops, you know, and it's had a really big effect here in Britain. I really love, there's a quote from, I think she might even have been on your show, you know, Rebecca Solnit, the great writer, she wrote a book called Hope in the Dark. she said about this, and I think You Can Cut is a really good illustration of it. Hope isn't a lottery ticket you can sit on your sofa and clutch feeling lucky. Hope is an axe you use to break down doors in an emergency. Everything that hope is not a passive thing. You know, you don't sit back and hope for things to get better. You act for things to get better. UK Uncut's a really good example of that. Actually, when I was trying to persuade people to join UK Uncut, it was examples from American history that I drew on, examples of how protest really came out. I don't know if we've got time, but just to give you two very quick examples that I don't know if your listeners know, but I think are incredibly powerful in terms of showing why this kind of action is so worthwhile. We've got some really interesting declassified documents from the Vietnam War, where people in 1965, scientists in the Pentagon, strategists in the Pentagon, go to Lyndon Johnson and they say, Mr. President, we've got a way to end this war now. We can scientifically prove it'll save lives. They tapped it onto the computer. Very easy. You nuke Hanoi. And LBJ, who, as you know, was, when it came to Vietnam, a real thug, was actually quite tempted by this and was really weighing it. And then one day, there was huge protests outside the White House, and he called these strategists back in, and he said, I just want you to put one more thing into this computer. I want you to figure out how long it'll take all those protesters out there to scale the White House wall and lynch their president if I do what you're telling me to do. And he explicitly said, I can't do it because the protest in the United States will be too great. Again, when the plan is put to Nixon years later, he said exactly the same thing. I bet all those protesters outside the White House that day went home thinking they'd failed. They probably even remembered it as a failure. Actually, they didn't realize that they had succeeded in preventing a nuclear war. That's so important for people to know, that protest raises the price of politicians making terrible decisions. And there's just one more story, I think, that illustrates that in a kind of amazing way in terms of the ripple effect of protest. A group of mothers whose sons died very early in the Vietnam War, and they set up a group called Mothers Against the War, which actually became quite a big movement later in the war. But there was something they did early on that they remembered as a terrible, humiliating failure. They called for every mother with a son in Vietnam to go to the White House and protest. And they turned up, and seven other women turned up. And all their lives, even when it became a really important movement, they remembered that with a real sting. Until one day in the 1990s, one of them happened to be reading the autobiography of Benjamin Spock, who was the guy who, you know, kind of almost like an Oprah of his day, a very influential child doctor, who was always on the radio, who'd come out against the war in 1968. It had been a big turning point. And he said why he did it. He said that he'd been in the White House one day in the early 60s, and he came, being briefed on the war, which at that time he supported. And he came out and he saw seven women protesting in the snow. Mm. And he remembered this. You know, it really seared in his memory. He thought, if these women are brave enough to speak out against the war, why aren't I? Why am I doing nothing? And he had nightmares about these women for years. And it was the memory of those women that made him come out against the war. So this thing that they had remembered as a failure had actually turned the course of history. You know, and I think when people are looking for something like UK Uncut and US Uncut, they're looking for a way to act. You know, you can say to people, you don't know what the ripple effect of your actions will be, but you know there will be a ripple effect. And the one certainty is, if you don't do anything, if you just sit at home and go, isn't it terrible that GE is ripping me off, is taking $3 billion of my money when I have to pay and I have to work, and if I don't pay my taxes, I go to prison. Isn't that awful? Instead of just sitting there and lamenting it, you can go out and you can change it.
Johan Hari from johanhari.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Great stuff. Great stories. I had never heard those.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the man paid